Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is a good death for a dog or a cat? For those of us who think of our pets as members of the family, watching them move into old age and physical decline can be tough, and deciding on the best way to comfort and care for them fraught with anxiety. My guest today understands these challenges on both a personal and a professional level. Bioethicist Jessica Pierce shares what she learned and experienced over the final year of her beloved dog Odie's life in her new book, The Last Walk, Reflections on Our Pets at the End of Their Lives. Jessica, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you started thinking about how this issue would affect you as you watched Odie approaching the final months of his life. Can you start off by telling us a little bit about him?
Sure. So Odie was a Vizsla, which for your listeners who don't know Vizslas, they're also called Hungarian Pointers, and they're unmistakable. They're very red and short-haired, beautiful dogs. They're hunting dogs, so they have that hunting dog look, the long nose and long ears, and often with Vizslas, a cropped tail. We got Odie when he was 10 weeks old from a family in Omaha, and he lived with us for 14 and a half years. He was our first child.
Yeah, you knew you wanted a dog before you knew you wanted a baby.
Absolutely. And yeah, it was good. It was really good training for then having a child 2 years later, because you learn a lot about your parenting styles and skills or lack thereof. And yeah, so Odie was our firstborn.
So what did you hope to learn about this entire process by journaling your own experiences in that last year?
Well, you know, I think it really started out less as an attempt to learn, the journal itself, as an attempt to deal with my grief. Mm-hmm. I thought about Odie's death long before he was even old, and it always was always sort of crouching in the back of my mind that someday this beloved creature would pass away, and that his arc of life would be much shorter than mine. And I worried about it. And I think as he started to really get frail, I was thinking about a book on how animals die, a much broader book than I actually ended up writing. It was about all kinds of animals and all kinds of manners of death. So I guess I just was in a place where I wanted to observe what was really happening to him and my own reactions to what was happening to him.
Well, I have to say, I can completely relate to the book. I have a 15-year-old dog at home, and she could not be sweeter. And it's strange to think about the idea that sometime here in the near future, she won't be part of our family. And like you, I had her before I had kids. And it is, you can always sort of project forward. The part that I never imagined when she was younger was this time when she's sort of getting older.
I didn't either. It's funny. I think when I thought about what Odie would be like as an old dog, I thought, oh, what a relief. He'll finally be calm. And he'll just lay at my feet and sleep. And, you know, that's the farthest thing from the truth. And, you know, if you knew Odie, you would know he was, I think most people are familiar with Marley. Mm-hmm. Odie is Marley times 100. Totally neurotic and destructive. But the most lovable, sweet, friendly creature the world has ever seen.
You know, one thing I appreciated in the book was that it's always clear how much you loved Odie and how much your husband and your daughter loved him. You're also candid about the fact that caring for an animal becomes more challenging as they start to fall a lot, they become incontinent, whatever. Can you talk about that mix you felt of empathy on the one hand and frustration on the other?
Yeah, it is really hard, and you find yourself, you know, it tests your patience. You know, Odie had this really difficult behavior that developed as he got old of barking. Mm-hmm. And it was this very funny kind of rhythmic bark. He would bark, and then he'd wait about 30 seconds, and he'd bark again. And he did it like all night, all day, and you can't help but get aggravated by it, but then you feel really guilty for being aggravated because, you know, the bark is probably a reflection of, you know, anxiety on his part or some kind of inner turmoil. But, and I don't know, it seems like things like, you know, pooping all over the house shouldn't matter to us because, you know, it's an animal's life we're talking about. But I think it's not entirely fair to the caregiver to say that those things don't matter because they do. They're very hard to deal with.
You know, on the other hand, there is this idea that some elderly animals may be, because of reasons like that, sort of euthanized before it's necessary from a health standpoint because they become harder to care for or they end up in shelters.
Yeah.
And can you speak to that?
Well, I think what happens sometimes is that people don't, they see behavioral changes in an elderly dog as the dog being bad.
Mm-hmm.
For example, incontinence. They might think, oh, all of a sudden my dog is being naughty and peeing in the house, you know, when in fact there's a medical condition underlying that incontinence, but they don't really know to ferret that out, or they just don't have, and I hate to say it, but I think some people don't have that really long-term commitment to an animal.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe see an animal more like a kind of a library book. You check it out, and when it's past its due date, you take it back.
Hmm.
And that's really sad because our animals give us their all, and I think we owe it to them to see them through to the end, even if it's a bitter end.
What do we know, Jessica, about our dogs' and cats' awareness of their own physical decline over time? Is it likely they remember that they used to be able to jump up on the couch or run alongside us for miles or whatever it might have been?
You know, I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I did. And I pondered that a lot with Odie, you know, as he, for example, we'd take him for hikes and our other dogs would romp around and chase squirrels and Odie just sort of drag along behind us and, you know, it's sad for me to watch. I don't know, honestly. There's really very little scientific exploration of animals' awareness of their aging and death. You know, I like to think, given how intelligent and emotional animals are, that they probably do have some awareness of changes. And they certainly adapt. I mean, Odie, he understood that he couldn't jump into the car anymore. Of course, it was after, you know, a number of attempts that failed.
Right.
But that's how we all learn.
Do animals in the wild ever die of old age?
They do, actually. And I think the common assumption is that they don't. And I think it isn't the most common form of death in the wild. But there are certainly animals that die of old age, and I was actually surprised to learn that in my research. Unfortunately, there isn't very much information on how animals age and die in the wild, so it's hard to say how often it occurs. I found exactly one book on the topic of elderly animals, and so it's really an area that's unexplored.
What is a good death for a pet? And are there blanket ethical guidelines that we can turn to, or does it really vary on a case-by-case basis?
I would say both.
Mm-hmm.
I think there, as we have in human ethics, some principles that we can assert. For example, you know, a good death for an animal, I would say, is a death that is relatively free of distress, pain, and suffering, and that is, you know, takes place in the presence of compassionate witnesses and is timely. That is to say, you know, it's an animal who has reached a point of suffering that cannot be alleviated and where death is really the compassionate choice. Now, how to decide exactly when that might be the case, is very, very individual.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of those situations, too, where it feels like you can tell for someone else's family what they ought to be doing, but it's so much harder when you're in that situation yourself and having to make the decision yourself.
I think that's true. And I guess I would say two things to that. One is I learned that I need to be very careful in passing judgment on other people because, you know, for example, I would hear stories from one of my friends and colleagues who's a euthanasia vet. She would tell me, for example, you know, a family deciding to put down two dogs who are siblings mm-hmm. at the same time, even though one of them was relatively healthy. And, you know, at first, my first reaction to that is, oh, my God, that's awful. But then as she talked about it and explained their reasoning, I thought, you know, that makes some sense. And it's really hard to be, I mean, you don't know everything that goes on. And it's been interesting to see that people reading my book have, at least some readers, have the reaction that, oh, my God, she waited way too long with Odie and made him suffer. Whereas my own sense was, if anything, I did it too soon.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the second point I was going to make is that the reactions of friends, especially people who know your dog or cat or other creature well, are invaluable because I think it's really hard to be objective mm-hmm. with our own animal because we love them so much and we don't want to lose them. We don't want to see them suffering. So I had to listen to friends of mine and to my husband, who was much more objective than I was, and to vets telling me, you know, Odie's really having a hard time.
That was another interesting thing that you explored really openly here, which is that sometimes it was a strain on your relationship because you had two different outlooks on the best way to manage the end of Odie's life.
Yeah. And that's when I talked about parenting approaches. That was really interesting when Odie was a puppy, just to see, you know, I never wanted to leave him at daycare. My husband's like, we need time together. We need to leave him at daycare. And of course, that same thing played out with our daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it can be hard when people, husband and wife, or, you know, parents and children have really different feelings about what should happen with an animal or even different senses of whether an animal is suffering or not. And, I think those just need to be resolved as much as possible through open conversation. And one thing that I write about in the book is about the idea of the advance directive, which is something that we have in relation to human end-of-life care, a chance to sit down and talk. I mean, with humans, of course, it's with the person themselves. What do I desire at the end of my life? You know, what are my values? But it's an opportunity with pets for a family to sit down together with a vet, perhaps, and just talk about, you know, which aspects of the animal's daily experience do they think of as making them happy.
Hmm.
And I think that can be really helpful in kind of getting consensus on how to move forward.
Bioethicist Jessica Pierce is my guest. She's author of the new book, The Last Walk, Reflections on Our Pets at the End of Their Lives. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House Kitchen, lecture, book signing, and hors d'oeuvres, October 16th with Chef John Hanney III. More at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is bioethicist Jessica Pierce. Her new book is called The Last Walk, Reflections on Our Pets at the End of Their Lives. Join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. I want to talk a little bit about management of pain, Jessica, because I think most of us could understand and recognize immediately if our pet was in acute pain, but the sort of aches and pains that we can imagine an elderly arthritic person having are a little harder to spot, a little harder to treat. Talk about that.
Okay. We're talking about chronic pain, and I'd say chronic pain is one of the most important and neglected areas of animal care. And I think part of the reason, as you suggest, is that it's really hard to recognize. We see an animal get stiff and slow down and, you know, like Odie maybe not want to jump in the car, not want to go for a very long walk, and we just think, well, it's the process of aging. He's getting old. And that's true, and it also might be that he's suffering from osteoarthritis, which is it's very common in older dogs, and it's relatively, well, I shouldn't say it's easy to treat. It isn't necessarily, but it should be treated. It can be treated. I say it's not necessarily easy from personal experience because I think Odie did suffer from some arthritis in his rear legs especially, but with him it was complicated because he had some neurological decline where signals weren't getting from his brain to his back legs. So he had a lot of weakness and stiffness in his back legs that was neurological, which vets assured me over and over was not painful because the nerves were actually damaged.
So you had to figure out where the line was between the arthritis and the...
Yeah. So I tried all kinds of medicines that in many dogs would probably be effective for osteoarthritis. But with Odie, they didn't work very well, if at all. But there are effective treatments. And the difficult thing is that it's just like treating pain in a human. You know, different people respond differently to different medicines. No, I might take ibuprofen for a headache, but, you know, my daughter likes Tylenol. It works better. And it's the same with animals that, you know, one medicine might be effective for one dog, but not so much for another. So there's a certain amount of trial and error and the need to be persistent with it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Pete in Arlington. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Chris. Thank you very much for taking the call.
Sure.
Just a couple of thoughts that I would ask the guest to respond to. They're really more thoughts than questions, and let me try to be very brief. It seems to me that end-of-life issues between humans and animals are converging to the same point. There's great discussion, sometimes candid and sometimes not, in this country about the money that's spent on humans in the last year of life. And I have friends who wanted to put a pet to sleep because the pet was sick but could be cured. And the vet said, no, I'm not going to put this animal to sleep for you. This animal can be cured, but the cure might be $2,000 or $3,000. I refuse to get a pet again because I don't want to be put in that position. So I, you know, in the first dog we had put to sleep after 16 years, the vet said, looked at that dog and said, you know, see how peaceful that was, and yet we won't let ourselves do that to humans, which opens up another whole set of issues. But my point is, it's becoming very expensive to own a pet because of the level of intervention and the expense of intervention. And in fact, you know, some pets now get better health care than kids do in this country. So I just would like your bioethicist guest to respond, and I'll take her answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Pete.
Well, Pete raises a number of really important questions. The first one that he mentioned was this issue of end of life, the way we die for animals is converging in a lot of ways with how humans die, particularly in that the advances in veterinary medicine are just amazing. You can do hip replacements and stem cell therapies and on and on. And on the one hand, these are fabulous things for our animals to have access to. And of course, on the other hand, two things happen. One, as Pete notes, care gets really expensive. And two, what's happened with human dying is that, you know, there's this whole array of possibilities. And when a family is asked, do you want to do X, Y, and Z for your, you know, beloved father or mother or child, really, it's really hard to give any answer other than yes, sort of no matter what they are, what they cost, because it feels like if you say no, you're denying that you love this person or this animal and denying them something that might keep them alive. And as veterinary care gets better, that's going to get more and more poignant. And I think it's absolutely true that a lot of vets, a lot of animals get better care than people, children, elderly. And often people are forced to make a really painful choice. You know, do I get medicine for my dog or do I get medicine for myself or for my child? And those are hard places to be. On the issue of a vet refusing euthanasia, that's really hard. And my response to that would be, I think for the most part, it really should be in the hands of the owner, the decision. But there are, there's this whole category of euthanasia that vets refer to as convenience euthanasia, where somebody comes in with a perfectly healthy animal and says, I want to get rid of this thing. I don't want it anymore. And I can't be bothered trying to find it another home. And vets are, a lot of vets are uncomfortable with those kinds of requests, and some will even refuse. Now, refusing to euthanize an elderly animal who's ill, I don't know. That's tough. I'm not sure that, I'm not sure I would approve of a vet refusing, but I don't know the details of that particular situation. But that sounds tough.
But Jessica, is there ethical justification for people who love a pet, have committed to its care, but still having to take financial considerations into account when deciding whether to provide sort of heroic measures to make a pet better or to let it go?
You know, I think in an ideal world, it'd be nice to say money shouldn't matter, mm-hmm. but it does. And I just think it's unfair to pet owners to say that it can't and shouldn't, because most people really struggle over those choices. And you gotta say no at some point, and people will make different judgment calls. You know, it may be that they'll refuse a treatment for an animal that I might think I would do in a minute, but I just don't think we can judge so easily.
Yeah.
And I guess the one thing I would say is that what seems really unfair to an animal is if a person who is well-positioned financially refuses to spend the money on even basic pain care.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Melissa on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Melissa.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I was calling because I have a 15-year-old Heeler Shepherd mix that I've had since I was 11 years old, so she is literally my child, my baby. And I work in hospice. And my husband actually made the comment the other day that I can recognize when humans require hospice care or need that sort of additional help, but I am sort of blinded when it comes to my own dog. And so I was just wondering sort of what point, I feel like I recognize it, but obviously I don't ever want to let her go. If she could live to be 80, that would be fabulous, but I know that's not realistic. So at what point did you start to recognize that Odie needed additional help or needed to get to the point where maybe euthanasia or something along those lines might need to be considered in the next year or 6 months or something along those lines? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Okay. Well, yeah, thanks for your story, Melissa. And, oh, I really feel for you. With Odie, it was, I would say there was really no watershed, but it was just an accumulation of events, and particularly when he would fall and could no longer get up. And he did this a few times. He'd wander around in the middle of the night because he was confused and restless. And then he would get into these funny corners of the house and get stuck. And then he would be incontinent. And so I'd wake up and he'd be covered in his own poop and stuck in a corner. And just the look in his eyes was one of just despair. And I think when it became hospice in my mind was when we talked with the vet about giving Odie a steroid. And it was actually quite near the end of his life. I'd say it was probably in the last month. She recommended that we give him some prednisone because his back end was so weak and he was having so much trouble walking. And as a matter of fact, the prednisone was like a miracle cure. And the next day he could walk. The problem was he had really bad, his liver panel was, he had a couple of liver enzymes that were really highly elevated, and prednisone was pretty dangerous for him and could have made him potentially very sick and even probably killed him. So I kind of had to make a choice between, you know, quality of life and prolonging his life. And I guess the one thing I would say is that, you know, if you shift into hospice mode, you're not giving up on your animal. You're just focusing your attention on care and on love and on making the last time that you have together, you know, the happiest that it can be for your animal. And when do you know that? That's the question I get the most often and that I have the hardest time answering, because I don't think you ever know for sure. You just have to, I think you have to trust your gut, and given how long you've lived with this animal and how much you obviously love her or him, I didn't catch what the gender was, you'll make a good choice.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We're speaking this hour with bioethicist Jessica Pierce about her new book, The Last Walk, Reflections on Our Pets at the End of Their Lives. Let's go next on the phone to Jane in Dallas. Hi, Jane.
Oh, hi, Chris. Hi, Jessica. I just want to thank you so much for your book. I have a wonderful, beautiful seeing-eye dog named Maddie, and we've been together 10 years, and I have been thinking about these very questions. I would say for almost a year now, I noticed that in November she was having a hard time getting up and downstairs, and now her hearing isn't what it used to be. We have to call her a lot, and that just, you know, wasn't my girl a year ago. And but yet, on the other side of the coin, she definitely still runs to the hall closet for her harness, and she still wants to go, and she, you know, still wants to lead. So I'm finding I can still work with her, but on just very little kind of door-to-door trips. I wouldn't take her on a long walk these days, and definitely not by ourselves. And one of the things I was so struck by in your book is how
family members can have a completely different perception on what needs to happen with your dog. My daughter wanted to take Maddie so I could get a new dog. She sees, you know, a seeing-eye dog is kind of mom needs a new dog, sort of like mom needs a new car.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the car is wearing out, and then we get the new car. And my husband, who never wants to make decisions for me or you know, he was like, do what you want to do, which was no really no help at all. And but finally, we kind of, my husband and I finally realized, I mean, we even talked about if we were to give Maddie to our daughter, how we would leave her. And we realized we couldn't leave her at the house and walk away because Maddie would wait by the front door, you know, forever. And it just, those little things. And so we were saying, okay, we'd have to give her to our daughter and her husband, and they'd have to take Maddie for a little ride or something. And then I finally realized I can't do it. And I have a lot of friends who they have a seeing eye dog that needs to retire, and they can retire that dog and then go get a new dog and bring the new dog into the home. And I've just now realized I can't do that either, that I love Maddie so much and she's given me so much that I'm just going to, I need the hospice time, as you say, just to really be able to concentrate on her and her needs. And I just, you know, these decisions are so wrenching. I mean, I've been crying for months, and I go see a therapist about it. And my therapist called me and said, you have to listen to this program. So thank you so much for this book. And I definitely will move heaven and earth to buy it and get it on tape or whatever so I can read it. But you and Chris, your questions too, both of you are so on the money as to what we go through because we love our animals so much. So I just want to say thank you.
Well, Jane, thank you so much for your call. Thank you for sharing your story. I'm so sorry that you're in this position at this point in your life. We'll come back to our conversation in a moment and maybe get some a word on Jane's statements from Jessica Pierce, the bioethicist who is author of the new book, The Last Walk, Reflections on Our Pets at the End of Their Lives. If you'd like to join the conversation, send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House Kitchen, lecture, book signing, and hors d'oeuvres October 16th with Chef John Hanney III. More at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with bioethicist Jessica Pierce. Her new book is called The Last Walk, Reflections on Our Pets at the End of Their Lives. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. And you'll recall, Jessica, in the last segment we heard from Jane telling us about the aging of her seeing eye dog and how difficult it's been for her to sort of deal with this reality essentially deal with the reality. Can you speak a little bit to Jane's comments?
Yeah, I the main thing that I was thinking listening to Jane speak was just what a lucky dog Maddie is. And my heart just goes out to Jane. And, you know, if only all human companions could be so thoughtful about the last part of their animal's life. And I think what I especially loved about Jane's comment was just that she reminds us that the end of our animal's life, the dying process, can be a time where we really cement our bond. It can be a time of growth and just allowing our animal to change and adapting to them. And just I do wish her well.
Can you talk about this? Jane mentioned that her daughter felt like it was simply time for her to get a new dog, and that, you know, ultimately this was a sort of a pragmatic possession that she had, and Jane has a much more nuanced emotional relationship with Maddie. Talk about grieving for an animal in a world where it seems people either get it or they don't.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think the best thing to do if you're grieving over the loss of an animal is find people who get it.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of people who get it. And, you know, it is hard because you'll get that kind of, well, it was just a dog, you can get another. Those kinds of comments really hurt. But there are many, many people who understand. And, you know, I was just thinking about this yesterday. It's such a small gesture, but one thing that I would highly recommend to people who have a friend or family member who has lost an animal is to send them a sympathy card.
Hmm.
We don't usually think of that when it's an animal that's died, but I got two sympathy cards when Odie died, and they obviously, I still remember exactly who they were from and what they said. They meant so much to me because it was somebody acknowledging that Odie meant that much to me and that his passing was really painful. And, you know, I think there are people, and there's actually research on this, people grieve more profoundly for an animal than they do sometimes for the loss of a human loved one. So I think the most important thing is just to find people who will acknowledge your grief. And there are actually some good resources on the internet, and there are a lot of bereavement counselors who are trained to help people with grief over an animal.
Talk about this. You write about, you would find out about things that we all ought to do to keep our pets healthy and in tip-top shape, and you would think, oh, no, I didn't brush Odie's teeth as much as I should have, and he was toothless because he ate, like, couches and back doors and the sides of barns and things like that. But there is still that sense, especially because we are in charge, right, of guilt.
Absolutely. And I'm a wonderful cultivator of guilt. I felt and still do. I still feel so much guilt over all the things done and not done, just that I don't think I was a bad pet owner because I did everything I could for Odie and for Maya and for my other critters, but my knowledge was limited in some areas. I didn't know until Odie was older that I needed to brush his teeth. And then when I was told by the vet that I should, I ended up not always doing it because he was such a pain in the butt.
Mm-hmm.
He hated it. And, you know, the annoyance of trying to do it and the torture that it seemed to put him through, you know, it's just not worth it. But, you know, seeing the state of his teeth when he was 14, I think, it would have been worth it and I should have done it. And I hear that so often from people, just especially guilt over the decision to euthanize.
Mm-hmm.
Just not knowing if it was the right thing to do and if it was the right time. And, you know, I think it's just part of the landscape of having a pet, and we need to, I think guilt tells us something important, that maybe there are things we can be doing better. But we also have to forgive ourselves for being fallible.
One thing you're adamant about, and I think this is important to bring up, is that we feel like the one thing we cannot bear is to be there when, as you call it, the blue needle is applied. But you feel like we really have an obligation to our animals.
I do think it depends on the individual to some extent, because there are, I mean, animals are extremely receptive to our emotional state.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some people who would be in such a state of distress watching the procedure that it might be really distressing for the animal. So I think there are situations where it might be better for the owner not to be present, but I think for the most part, it's something that we owe our animals. to be with them, holding their paw at the very end. And it can be a wonderful experience. I don't think it is for everybody, and not all euthanasias go smoothly. And I think people should be prepared for that. It's good to know ahead of time, you know, exactly what's going to happen. And there are things that you might, if you weren't prepared, you know, for example, the agonal breath, you might think that your animal was struggling for breath when in fact it's, you know, the final gasp of dying, and mm-hmm. they're really unaware of it. So, yeah.
One thing I didn't know, Jessica, that I'm glad I learned reading this book, is that there are vets who will make house calls for exactly this purpose. So you don't have to take them to the place they hate most in the world.
Yes.
For the end of their lives, if the decision is made that they really need to be euthanized.
Yeah. And I think, so there are mobile vets who will come and do veterinary care in your home, which is wonderful for an elderly animal because it can be painful to get in the car or, you know, stressful to go to the vet's office, and that can be hard on elderly animals. And it's the euthanasia procedure can be done in the home, and I so recommend it. You know, if you can manage it, because it's so peaceful for the animal. Odie's end really was. It was so nicely done, and so peaceful for him. He just was asleep on the couch and didn't wake up. And I think more and more vets are offering mobile services, and there are more and more vets who are focusing on euthanasia in particular and on hospice.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Jerry in McKinney. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, I just wanted to say what a great topic. And you know, I've rescued dozens of animals in the last several years, and I've had some that were, you know, my personal animals and very close to my heart, and you just kind of have a feel for when it's time. But I've actually had vets that would kind of, you know, pressure me to have operations on old dogs and things like that. And I just think it's really sad when sometimes people overlook the animal's needs for their own personal needs. You know, when you're having the sixth operation on a 20-year-old chihuahua, you know, maybe you're kind of overlooking what's best for the animals. And it's always important to think about the animal, in my opinion, before your own personal feelings. That's all I wanted to say. Thanks for the show.
Thanks for your call. What do you think about that, Jessica?
You know, I think that's absolutely true. And we had that experience with Odie that I had two different vets who I was seeing. One was a mobile vet, and then one was our longtime vet at the clinic. And the mobile vet that I found, based on somebody's recommendation, was pretty aggressive in wanting me to pursue treatments. And it made me really uncomfortable because she was recommending, you know, back surgery for Odie, who's 14 years old, who can't even... It takes an hour to get a blood draw from Odie because he's so nervous about it. And mm-hmm. just thought, well, she doesn't know Odie, and she doesn't know how stressful it is for him. So I think Jerry's absolutely right that, you know, it has to be the person who knows the animal the most who decides. And unfortunately, the animal can't tell us themselves, but we have to decide for them if putting them through more tests and more treatments isn't going to cause them more suffering than simply euthanizing them.
We have an email here from Nicole who asks, how do we interpret the quality of a pet's life? Our formerly 50-pound dog is 16. She's lost a lot of weight. She's blind, deaf, arthritic, and suffers from canine cognitive disorder. We spend close to $200 a month on medicine and prescription food and have been glad to do it, even though it's a lot of money for us. She writes, he can't walk more than a few steps at the time. He gets confused, stuck, and will soil his space like your dog if we can't get him fast enough out the door. His liver panels and heart have been okay, but I just feel like, Nicole writes, he's not getting any enjoyment out of life at all. How does one judge?
Oh, gosh, that's a really hard point. But I think that this person is on exactly the right track, that you basically have to make an assessment of their how much happiness they're getting out of their day. And, you know, are they having more good days than bad? And, you know, one thing you can do is make a list of the things that are most important to your animal, and that'll be different for each animal. You know, maybe for Odie, it's eating hot dogs and saying hi to children. But, you know, for another dog, you know, there are special things that give them enjoyment, being close to their person, you know, laying on the couch with them or whatever. And when they can't do those things anymore, then you start to really question quality of life. And I think it's really, there's no easy answer to that. You just have to make a daily assessment, and when it starts to day after day not look so good, then you start thinking about euthanasia. There's a quality of life scale called the PASPA scale, which I can send a link to that to the station, and maybe they can put it on the website.
Yeah, and it's essentially, and I'll just summarize here, but sure, the link would be great. It's hurt, hunger, hydration, hygiene, happiness, and on the other side, mobility and more good days than bad.
Yeah, and I think the value of something like this is just that it allows you to be a little objective in kind of just assessing various aspects of quality of life, which is really hard when you're so close to an animal.
So it's been just under a year for you, is that right, since you lost Odie?
It's been, you know, it's actually been, it seems like a year, but it's actually been 2 years,
okay. Talk a little bit about your family's healing process.
You know, my first reaction is I don't ever want to get another dog.
Yeah.
Even though we have little Maya, she's 9 and a half. So I'm already committed to dealing with this.
You're locked in.
Right. I'm locked in. And we actually, against my better judgment, we got a cat.
Mm-hmm.
Only better judgment in the sense that I didn't really want to get any more animals yet, because it still feels really raw.
Yeah.
But, of course, now I'm totally committed to this little guy whose name is Thor. He's sitting right here, almost on top of the phone. I think, you know, we all went about it in our own ways. You know, for me, it was keeping the journal. And I memorialized Odie in various ways around the house. I'm looking at a picture of him over my desk, and I have his collar hanging from my lamp. And I have his ashes right near me in the office. I took some of his ashes up to the mountains right near where we used to always hike with Odie, but some of them I've kept, and just honoring him.
Jessica Pierce's new book is called The Last Walk, Reflections on Our Pets at the End of Their Lives. Jessica, thank you so much for sharing this hour with us.
Thanks for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces our podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. Learn more about the show at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.